podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Thank you. I love you guys, you know. I haven't said anything, you're already clapping. Good evening. My name is Britney Spears. Only sometimes. My name is Chris Abani. I'm a writer. And I have had this wonderful opportunity to be here tonight to be part of the Lannan Readings and Conversations series. The Lannans have been really good to me personally as a writer with beautiful fellowships and residencies. And the foundation has transformed in many ways literature and has made it permissible for literature to have a political focus and not be shy of it. You know how most U.S. writers used to kind of pretend they weren't political. And Lannan has made that possible and acceptable. So tonight I'm here to be in conversation with a friend of mine, Kwame Dawes. And I'm going to do a formal introduction. But I met Kwame in 1996 in London. And Kwame was I'd never taken a creative writing class before. I had published two books at this time. And I turned up at Kwame's workshop. Kwame used to fly from America to Britain because a lot of the black British poets and writers had no access to teaching. And he would run free workshops for us, and so we'd all go. And one of the first things I remember is we all sat in the room, and we had to go around and introduce ourselves. And everybody said, oh, you know, my name is Joe Bloggs, I'm a poet. My name is Peter, so I'm a poet. And we went around the room, and finally Kwame said, boy, I've published 6 books, and I don't even call myself a poet. So you're just a poet because you say you're a poet? And it was really remarkable because the conversation really started from there. So I'm going to do a formal introduction, and I hopefully Kwame will read. And I want to remind you that there will be a book signing afterwards. And I cannot recommend Kwame's books enough. But I'm going to start with a poem by Kwame from this book, called Bruised Totems. It is a book, I think, that was organized around an exhibition of African artifacts, and he was asked to write poems to match it. So the poem I will read goes with this cross from the Congo. I presume. Oh, and I kind of think it's funny because I asked him to give me a poem to read at the beginning, and he gave me one that had to do with Jesus, which is cruel because I got kicked out of seminary twice. So I don't know what's going on. I presume. So if there's lightning, just duck. I presume. Jesus, I never expected to run into you here, but that is faithlessness. Forgive me, friend. Still, it's nice to see you hanging here, black like me, locks all falling down, your poor ribs pulled apart on that wooden cross, your navel jutting like an Accra child, your nipples swollen like a woman before suck. How they have suffered, O Savior, how they have bled. Here at the crossroads, the sun has traversed the sky to meet the souls here, silently staring at your body, starkly there in the bush. Give thanks for the sacredness of wood, of brass, of iron, and the tapestry of nails. Kwame Senil Neville Dawes was born in Ghana in 1962. And you know that he was born in Ghana because he has 4 names. And grew up in Jamaica, where he attended Jamaica College and the University of the West Indies at Mona. He studied and taught in New Brunswick on a Commonwealth scholarship to Canada. And since 1992 has been teaching at the University of South Carolina. He is a professor of English on the Columbia campus of that institution, where he is distinguished poet in residence and director of the South Carolina Poetry Initiative. His critical articles on literature, theater, and film have been published widely. He is an actor, playwright, and producer, an accomplished storyteller, broadcaster, and was the lead singer in Ujamaa, a reggae band. To date, Kwame has seen produced 15 of his plays, and he has acted in, directed, or produced several of these productions. His major works, which have had successful runs in Jamaica and tours in the Caribbean and Canada, include Friends and Almost Lovers, Brown Leaf, Charades, Even Unto Death, Charities Come, In Chains of Freedom, In the Warmth of the Cold, Dear Pastor, and Song of an Injured Stone. During the early 1990s, Dawes was the founder and artistic director of the Christian Graduate Theatre Company. Productions of his plays have won several theatre awards in Jamaica. His new play, One Love, published by Methuen in London in 2001, was inspired by the novel Brother Man by Roger Mize. And it opened at the Bristol Old Vic in the UK in April 2001 under the direction of Yvonne Brewster. One Love completed his successful run in Hammersmith in London in July of the same year. And his other play, Stump of the Tabernacle, was the winner of the Trinidad and Tobago's National Schools Festival in 2001. There's more. And if by now, like me, you're feeling vaguely jealous, it will get worse. In 2003, Stump toured with the St. Louis Black Repertory Theatre Company under the direction of artistic director Ron Hines. In 2010 and 2011, People Tree Books will be publishing four new volumes of the plays of Kwame Dawes, finally bringing into print a body of Dawes' theatrical work that spans his 30 years as a playwright. Dawes has published 13 collections of poetry, Progeny of Air, which won the Forward Prize, Resisting the Enemy, Prophets, Jaco Jacobus, Requiem, a suite of poems inspired by the illustrations of African-American artist Tom Feelings in his landmark book, The Middle Passage, White Ships, Black Cargo, Shook Foil, a collection of reggae-inspired poems, Midland, which was awarded the Hollis Summer Poetry Prize by the Ohio University Press. He also won a Pushcart for the Best American Poetry of 2001 for his long poem Inheritance. His more recent titles include New and Selected Poems 2003, Wisteria, which was a finalist for the Patterson Memorial Prize, Impossible Flying, Goma's Song, Hope's Hospice, and Back of Mount Peace. He has published several books of fiction, including the short story collection A Place to Hide, She's Gone, which was published by Akashic in 2007 and won the prestigious Hurston Wright Legacy Award for Best Debut Fiction. In 2009, People Tree Books published his second novel, Biovac. Dawes' nonfiction work includes his definitive study of the lyrics of Bob Marley, Bob Marley, Lyrical Genius, and his seminal work on postcolonial aesthetics, Natural Mysticism Towards a New Reggae Aesthetic. In 2007, his memoir, A Fire Cry from Plymouth Rock, A Personal Narrative, appeared. He has edited many volumes, including a collection of interviews with Caribbean poets, Talk Your Talk, interviews with Anglophone Caribbean poets, Wheel and Come Again, an anthology of reggae poems, 20 South Carolina Poetry Fellows, Seeking Poems, Celebrating the Art of Jonathan Green. In 2007, Kwame Dawes and the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting collaborated to produce Hope, Living and Loving with HIV in Jamaica, a multimedia exploration of the epidemic's human face. The interactive website, livehopelove.com, combines Dawes' poetry with original music, essays, documentaries, and personal video recollections from those living with the disease and those who care for them. The work was featured in Virginia Quarterly Review, The Washington Post, Public Television's Foreign Exchange, and the McNeil Lear News Hour. It was also the subject of an hour-long radio documentary. Hope received an honorable mention in the 2008 Knight Batten Awards for Innovations in Journalism. It is part of the Pulitzer Center series on HIV/AIDS in the Caribbean, and it also won an Emmy in the category for New Approaches to News. I told you, by the end of this introduction, like me, you'll be really jealous. In 2009, Dawes was commissioned by the state newspaper to write a poem to commemorate the inauguration of Barack Obama. The result is a long sonnet sequence, New Day, which was published in the state newspaper and was featured on the state's website. I could go on. There is a lot more, several pages more. But what I really want to say about Kwame Dawes is less about this kind of accomplishment, which is kind of remarkable given that Kwame was born in 1962. He has more poetry collections than people who've lived longer than him. He's accomplished in fiction and nonfiction. He's accomplished in playwriting. It's his generosity, the way he mentors young students. In fact, any of you who may have seen him at the school yesterday will know what I'm talking about. And that's really, I think, the best thing I can say about Kwame, that he's talented, that he's gifted, that he's humble, but more importantly, that he's a kind, kind man. Please welcome Kwame Dawes.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris, for that rather long litany of the stuff I do, but for that generous introduction. Chris is a good friend, and we've known each other for a number of years, and it's always good to hang out with Chris. Separate apart from his brilliance as a writer, he's a good man and a good friend. This is a tremendous honor for me, and I'm very pleased to be able to do this. I thank the Lannan family and for all those who've helped to make this happen. And I thank you for coming out and for being a part of this. My plan is that we will enjoy ourselves today, tonight. And if you don't, that's really too bad, because I certainly plan to enjoy myself. So, life. The other thing I'll say is I can barely see you, which is helpful to me, because I'm going to presume that you're all elated and riveted by my brilliance. And if you're not, again, too bad. I really, that's life. So I'm going to read some work for you, and hopefully you'll come on this journey with me. It's a great song by Bob Marley that is sometimes a refrain that keeps coming to me. It's a song about history. And it's a song about roots. It simply goes, roots, natty roots, dread, bingy, dread. 'Cause I and I are the roots. Got to survive in this man-made oppression. Got to survive in iration. Roots natty, dread bingy, I and I are the roots. I and I are the roots. What are these, so withered and wild in their attire? Streetcar catch a fire, passengers glowing like coals, and who are these come wailing this way like zombies, arms stretched out, skin melting from their bones? These are my enemies with worms in their eyes. These are my enemies with worms in their eyes. Don't you know that I am fat man? You could be my little boy. Since August 1945, I've ruled the sky, turned day into night. See me big, big fat man. I want you to be my little boy. Count not the casualties of war. Count the fronts that are gained. Women and children are soldier factories. Eliminate them and become death. The slaughterer of worlds, hawk-eyed and swift, I swoop down and plunder. Obey me, play rock and roll, or you will be my enemies with worms in your eyes. Don't you know that I am fat man? I want you to be my little boy. 'Cause we could rule the nations hand in hand. We could rule the nations hand in hand. Market Jesus and baseball caps together hand in hand. Market Jesus and Hollywood together hand in hand. Don't you know that I am fat man? I want you to be my little boy. Roots, natty roots, dread bingy dread. It's a poem for Haiti. I'll read two poems thinking of Haiti. January 12th, 2010, Tombs. Every crumbled building is a tomb. We step over gray crushed bricks and the entanglement of steel. The faint scent of death still in the air. Every sliver of laughter dries in the heat, the dust, the stones, the dust, the stones. The doctor offers a wry smile, shrugs his shoulders and says, c'est la vie qui part, vie c'est une terrible. He points to the gray slabs of cement where the hospital once stood. He counts 18, the women in maternity with their new babies and their families counting fingers and toes. They were on the second floor. On the first were the diligent nurses. At the top were the broken bodies of the healing. They are all entombed in the stone. For days, the scent of their rotting blanketed our skins. Now, after the blue-helmeted soldiers sprayed the ruins, and they've done this before, it is bearable. Death sulks in the corner like our hearts, which leap at each sound of rumbling. The city dances to live, the music leaping against despair. An old woman skips to avoid a truck. This earth devours the dead with such efficiency, and we are left with our heads covered in dust, our eyes searching for familiar faces, and our hearts safely tucked away. It's a poem called Senses. One. Our trauma teaches us how to hear the rumble of a truck hurtling through the city of potholes and broken bricks. The shudder, we know the sound of the ground mumbling, hungry, always hungry. Two. Our trauma teaches us how to see every edifice, each story a calculation of survival. Nothing lasts forever. The standing things must soon be laid low. The solid turned to the pulverized dust of loss. I enter each building, eyes pulsing. Three. Our trauma teaches us how to smell the scent of honeysuckle and lavender, the pungent of ripe mangoes, the dull stench of sewers, stagnant for days, the sweet rot of old garbage soaked by rain, the steamed, the rank of urine staining the cracked walls, the hum of bodies still buried under the stones, a faint decay we grow used to, why we spit and then cross ourselves as we pass by. Four. Our trauma teaches us how to feel the warm flesh we hold, the living who are still with us, the grace of bodies touching, the rough grit of concrete blocks we lift and lift, pushing past the chaos, trying to find what has been lost, what we have not touched for months, pushing past the hard caging of steel and stone, seeking out the soft give of fingers beneath the stone, the caress of cloth, the wet of flesh. And five, our trauma teaches us how to taste the salt of sweat on our skin, the salt of tears, the salt of blood. These days, when we lick our faces and fingers. We want to taste what it is to bleed and sweat. We taste the funk in our skins, the musk on our tongues, the salt of cracked lips, the long kiss, the salt in the evening air down by the sea's edge, the salt of dust rising, the salt in our cocoa, the salt in the dust lifting from the ruins, and then the sweet news of stewed garden eggs, the surprise of honey, the taste of the air cool at evening time, the darkness coming quicker than normal, the clouds gathering over Port-au-Prince, rushing across the shelter of the mountains, the sweetness of the sudden rain on our tongues. Thank you. Thank you. I lived in Canada for a number of years. I studied there, and I say I studied there, but really what I did was I played in a reggae band, and then in my off days I would I did some work. When I finished my degree, my PhD, my doctorate, I was looking for some gainful activity to do while I played in my reggae band. And I, at that point, had a child and I was married. And so there were pressures, shall we say, to playing in a band, you make $50 for a gig if you're lucky. And then the establishment gives you liquor, which I don't drink liquor, so that doesn't really help me much. So I needed to find some gainful employment, as they say. I needed to find some work. So what I decided to do was to try and see if I could get a job with the Canadian, the government. And my task was to visit the fish farms in New Brunswick, Canada, and determine whether they were raising the fish right. I don't know if I mentioned that my PhD is in English literature, but I got the job. So anyway, while I was in Canada, this is a long preamble to read the poem to you, because while I was there, I had trouble with immigration, because I was playing in a band and I didn't have papers to do that. And the Canadians are funny about stuff like that. So, at one stage they decided to deport me, which was a little unnerving. So, through all kinds of mechanisms, I was able to get some reprieve, which took me to a place called Halifax. And while in Halifax, I was waiting for some paperwork to be done to let me stay in Canada. And I was in a restaurant and I overheard two women discussing their trip to Jamaica. And these were more elderly women, and they seemed a little worse for wear after the trip. Well, they were, they didn't get the memo about sun. You know, it was clear that the tropic sun had not been merciful on them, which they didn't realize because they were very proud of their tan. And but they were deeply, deeply upset about their return trip when they were at the airport and a woman, obviously an old Jamaican woman, decided to come into the country with contraband material, food and things like that. And they were very upset about that and they thought she should know better. Well, as these things happened, it turns out that as I listened to these women, I knew the woman. I knew exactly who they were talking about. I was going to say, I know her and her name is Thelma, but that didn't seem like the thing to tell them at that point. So then I decided, I'll write a poem about it, which I was quite certain they would read one day. So this is the poem about Thelma and her precious cargo. She was bringing fried fish, festival, banana, dumpling, rose corn, sweet sugar cane, nicely peeled and cool, when the plastic glove customs officer, squinge up him nose like him smelling his upper lip, decide to break every fruit, got open the fish, spilling all that white flesh and sweet fried tomato all over the counter. Same was searching for jugs, searching for disease from this great-grandmother, with centuries springing in her eyes, who come just to catch a sight of the children she never met and who might grow up without the grounding of stories she'd been carrying for all these years. But Thelma never panicked before, no child. She simply gathered the runes and then spread her bandana, flaming red with yellow light, on the blue stale carpet in a corner, and she placed every injured offering on the shimmering surface. Thelma light a red candle and draw a circle round the feast like a prayer. And then she invite the people them who line up to face the plastic gloves man to come sit with she and her grandson who's smiling like he can't stop all this time and eat a good sunrise meal, no fuss, just this laughing in her eyes. and them drink off all that sweet sap juice laced with a little Appleton fire. Appleton is rum, by the way. Appleton fire, and them eat that food like communion. And when them was finished, Thelma say a prayer and whisper a little forgiveness to the boy with the gloves. And then calmly, them wobble through the customs, clean as a priest before service, with all the drugs and disease swimming and singing in them belly, walking like that into the sweet Canadian air, warm as ever and ready. And Thelma tell this story again and again, and end it with the last sweet lines. She said, "Child, them should have followed it to the toilet today. For some of them seed find soil and see the tree them there still. Africa people been carrying them possessions in them shit forever." Precious cargo, child. Precious cargo. And man, we couldn't stop laugh. Yeah. True story. The students who I spoke to the other day know what this true story thing is about. Everything I say is true, absolutely true. I did some work some years ago interviewing some African-American women who told me their stories about their life growing up in Jim Crow South. And their stories led me to write poems about them. And I want to share just a couple of poems with you from that sequence of poems that I wrote for them. This is a poem called Tornado Child. This is for a woman called Rosalie Richardson. "I am a tornado child. I come like a swirl of black and darken up your day. I whip it all up into my womb, lift you and your things, carry you to where you've never been, and maybe if I feel good, I might bring you back all warm and scared, heart humming wild like a bird after early sudden flight. See, I'm a tornado child. I tremble at the elements. When the thunder rolls, my mother womb trembles, remembering the tweak of contractions that tightened to a wail when my mother pushed me out into the black of a tornado night. I'm a tornado child. You can tell us from far by the crazy of our hair. Couldn't tame it if we tried. Even now I tie a bandana to silence the din of anarchy in these kaya-thick plats. I'm a tornado child. Born in the whirl of clouds, the center crumbled, then I came. My lovers know the blast of my chaotic giving. They tremble at the whip of my supple thighs. Tornado child, you cross me at your peril. I cling to light when the warm of anger lashes me into a spin. The pine trees bend to me, swept in my gyrations. I am a tornado child. And when a spirit takes my head, I hurtle into the vacuum of white sheets blowing and paint a swirl of color streaked with my many songs. 'Cause I'm a tornado child." Rosie. Thank you. And Rosie taught me that, because Rosalie Richardson, she introduced herself and said, "My name is Rosalie Richardson and I'm a tornado child." So you get stuff like that as a poet and you figure, she's never going to read this, so you steal it. No, she read it. She was fine with it. This is another poem from that sequence. And it's a poem called Stillborn. And I should say that when I was interviewing these women, and these women were average age about 80 years old when I interviewed them in 1995, they would all talk about their siblings. When I talked to ask them how many siblings did they have, they would talk about those siblings who had died in childbirth as if they were there with them. And they would list them amongst their siblings who were lost. And to a person, they all had two or three siblings who had died in childbirth. And in one instance, a woman talked about her mother dying in childbirth. So I wrote this poem as an homage to those who had passed and those who carry the loss of that past all these years. It's called Stillborn. There's a Negro spiritual that speaks of, it's a very harrowing thought, because in that song, the singer is saying, "Take my baby home. I am free and never will be. I ain't free and never will be, so take my baby home." When somebody can be taken to the place where they prefer to see their child go, it should tell you something about what life they were feeling and facing. Take my baby home. Take my baby home. I ain't free and never will be. Take my baby home. Oh, glory. Oh, glory. There is room enough in paradise to have a home. I still count them, feeling them like ghost limbs. There is a place in my collection of years. Remembering them is a way to remember to count the pressure pills, the heart pills, the blood pills, the tyranny of pills. I count those who died before they woke, those I cradled, caressed, cocooned to live, hoping beyond the weakness of their cries. They died too, leaving us with tough questions for God Almighty. Old black folk have buried so many babies in the bush behind the cotton groves, with a naked form of cotton bale standing like sentinel crucifixes against the stale blue of summer skies. Oh glory, oh glory, there is room enough in paradise to have a home. And mother gathers her body and the tears, builds new fires, cooks new meals, readies her womb to replenish its rooted self, to make more brothers, more sisters like second nature. She carries her mourning like a second skin, a way to count the days. My mother bore 9 children. We chant this as a litany of her strength. 3 did not live to see their second year. And she did not live to see the second year of her washed belly, washed soul, washed body, the thin film of her drying birth waters scraped off with a rough cloth as they laid her out to rest. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long way from home. Remember I told you I was doing this job with the fish farms and all that? Well, here's the truth of what happened. This is true. They gave me a contract for 6 months. And then I was supposed to do the report at the end of 6 months. Well, I think it was 8 months. And I would do the report at the end of the 8 months, hand it in, and, you know, that would be it. So I would work during that time. So what I did, though, was I worked for the first month. And then I wrote the report. And then I put the report away, of course. And then for the rest of the 7 months, I wrote poetry. Because they had these computers and like photocopiers and all kinds of stuff in the office. And you know, so Sometimes I would be in my office, though they thought I was in the field, but I really wasn't. I was just writing. And again, some people would feel guilty about something like this, but not me. I didn't feel much guilt about it because I had paid enough money into Immigration Canada over the years to feel justified in this filching of time from these people. The good, noble news of all of this, and this is something that would make you feel good if you're laughing and feel bad about laughing with me, is that I wrote really good poems. and we are all happy about this. So this is the poem that started that process, and it's a poem called Progeny of Air, and it's the title poem for my first collection of poems. And so this is the poem called Progeny of Air. Like I said, the Bay of Fundy was where they farmed salmon. It was a place where they farmed salmon. So this is the story, Progeny of Air. The propellers undressed the sea, the pattern of foam like a broken zip opening where the bow cuts the wave and closing in its wake. The seals bark. Gulls call and dive, then soar loaded with catch. The smell of rotting salmon lingers over the Bay of Fundy like a mortuary's disinfected air. Fish farms litter the coastline, metal islands cultivating with scientific precision these gray-black, pink-fleshed fish. In the old days, salmon would leap up the river to spawn, journeying against the current. They are travelers. When tucked too low, searching for undertows to rest upon, they often scrape their bellies on the sharp adze and bleed. Now watch them turn and turn in the cages, waiting for the feet of colorized herring to spit from the silver computer bins over the islands of sea farms. And general, the hugest of the salmon has a square nose where a seal chewed on a super freeze night when her blood panicked and almost froze. Jean-Pierre, the technician and sea cage guard, thinks they should roast the general in onions and fresh seawater. It is hard to read mercy in his stare and matter-of-factly way. He wears layers, fisherman's uniform, passed from generation to generation. The plaid shirt, the stained yellow jacket, the ripped olive-green boots, the black slack trousers with holes, the whisker and eye of sparkle as if salt sea has crystallized on his sharp cornea. He guides the boat in, spills us out after our visit with a grunt and a grin, willing us to wet our sneakers at the water's edge. The sun blazes through the chill, the motor sputters, the sea parts, and then zips shut and still. Stunned by their own intake of poison, the salmon turn belly up on the surface, then sucked up by the plastic piscillator, they plop limp and gasping in the sunlight. One by one, the glove technicians press with their thumbs the underside of the fish, spilling the eggs into tiny cups destined for the hatchery. Anesthetized eyes glaze shock on the steel deck. They know the males from the females, always keep them apart, never let seed touch egg, never let the wind carry the smell of birthing through the June air. Unburdened now, the fish are flung back in. They twitch, then tentative as hungover denizens of nightmares, they swim the old Sisyphean orbit of their tiny cosmos. The fish try to spawn at night, but only fart bubbles and herring. On the beach, the rank saltiness of murdered salmon is thick in the air. Brown seaweed sucks up the blood. The beach is a construction site of huge cement blocks which moor the sea cages when tossed 80 feet down. They sink into the muddy floor of the bay and stick. There is no way out of this prison for the salmon. They spin and spin in the algae green netting, perpetually caught in limbo, waiting for years before being drawn up and slaughtered, staked and stewed. And in the morning silence, the sun is turning over for a last doze, and silver startles the placid ocean. Against the gray green of Deer Island, a salmon leaps in a magical arc, slaps the metal walkway in a bounce, and then dives, cutting the chilled water on the other side, swimming is general. This is my fantasy. With a square nose and skin gone pink with seal bites escaping from this wall of nets and weed, General swims upriver alone, leaping the current with her empty womb, leaping still instinct, still traveling to the edge of Lake Utopia, where after so many journeyings, after abandoning the secure world of spawning and living at the delicate hands of technicians, after denying herself social security and the predictability of a steady feeding and the safety from predator seal and osprey, after enacting the Sisyphean pattern of all fish, here in the shadow of the Connor's sardine factory, she spawns her progeny of air and dies. Okay, just a few more poems left. Are you okay? That's very good. I'm happy to hear that. I'm going to read some poems that honor, I think, the voices that are often very important to me in my work. And I read a poem for my daughter, Senna, who is now She's a freshman at university now, and we're decidedly relieved about that. She's a darling. She's sweet. There's nothing dangerous about Senna. But I'll read the poem for Senna, and it's called Akwaba, and it's a poem that I wrote upon her birth. I have many friends who have children and who are poets, and unfortunately, when we have children as poets, we want to write about the birthing of our children, and then everything they do, they burp, they fart, we write a poem about that. And while you're in the middle of it, everything seems decidedly exciting. The truth is that there's nothing particularly interesting about that because everybody does it. You know, it's not that distinctive. I had to write at least one poem, and for each of my children, about their birthing moment. And this is Senna's, and then I left it at that until I wrote about something else later on. So it's called Akwaba. And think New Brunswick, Canada. She was born on the 15th of February. Just balmy weather at that time of the year. Okay. Akwaba for Senna. Brown stone lines the roadways. The still gray city of whispers in the sunrise inches into bloom. I see your slick, wet head swaddled in a sheet of blood, your mother breathing into the half-light, Senna wailing across my heart. Lorna stares at the television, not recording the flicker of lights, just willing love to flow slow in warm streams of her milk into your quick suck mouth, locked on like a fish in passion. Picture this, my heart solace. Forever I'll watch your eyes blaze through my dim lensless blur. Forever, sweet Senna, gift from God Almighty. Akwaba, Akwaba, Akwaba. Thank you. And Akwaba in my mother's tongue means welcome. So that was my welcome poem for my daughter. And I want to read another poem for Senna, since my other two kids are not around, because they get very, you know, they're very particular about the fact that I read at least one poem about each of them. And so I'm not doing that because they're not here and I really don't care. I want to read another poem that I wrote for Senna, but it's really a poem about art, and it's called Sunstrokes, and it's really based on the work of an artist called Aubrey Williams, who is an artist from Guyana, and his paintings are typically abstract works. And very, 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 very shocking and complex works, but really worth the time you spend trying to understand them. So I'm trying to find my poem for my... There we go. All right. You notice what I'm using, by the way. I'm using an iPad. Apple pays me to do this kind of thing. All right. I wish. All right. This is for Senna again. It's called Sunstrokes. All of this is true, by the way. I never make up any of this stuff. It's actually true. Swear to God. One. My daughter tells me that the sun is a ball of gases, that flames are hard to define, but heat, she understands. Pressure plus gases equals heat. These equations, she explains. She's 6 this month. 2. Bonfires around martyrs were merciful. Why my daughter knows this is beyond me. Wet straw stuffed into the dark cleavages in the bramble before the execution caused the smoke to kill. A few coughs and then an airless, painless death while the muttering priest repeated Hail Marys full of grace. My daughter tells me most of this, a prelude to an impossible question, I fear. But she has no questions, really. She just asks, did you know? 3. Sometimes I see a bloated head in the sun, the shape of a boxer's clean-shaven head from behind. I'm seeing paintings the way my daughter does, finding the poetics of discovery in the things I don't know. There, see that swath of red paint? It is a flame frolicking over his crumbling back, red patterns sending threads of yellow smoke into the blue, all dancing at the edges of the sun, the gases, the heat, sunspot, maximum. I know what it means. At the edges, everything flakes into a sun-beaten smear of oil on uncured canvas, the way art rots in the humid tropics. 4. All that is left is a scream that makes us turn only to be blinded by the sun. Amber threads, our web threads, web our vision's edge with false gold, unreliable as the scream we heard. It was not my daughter, though I thought it was. I imagined it. She is sitting there among open art books, telling stories to herself, a sweet calculus of faith. The refraction of flaming color from the glossy prints catches her skin, a fire. No smoke here, just the pure embrace of flame and light as her hands run over the soft paper blue skies. And then she explains that mystery too, the blue of skies. And then she's whole again. Thank you. She hasn't been able to choose a major yet. We hoped. You know, physics or something. But it's, no. She's a musician. What can I say? Here's a poem for my wife, Lorna. It's called Sketch. Sketch for Lorna. With graphite, I soften your bones, make exotic the absence of your lashes. Show your fingers, long and elegant, cradling a plum, the light of its juice flaming vermilion through taut skin. I etch out your gaze, tender, tender, about your forehead where the pain has seared the skin, softly as if in the soft lead I can calm it all, make it go away. Are you going? With the soft of my palm's heel, I caress the bald glow of your head. Then clean a gray line where your brows were. Now there is nothing. These markings of what you have suffered. These days, bodies crumble about me. The dead, desperate for healing, grow weary, stoic, then quietly go. My blackened fingers make you round, plump, as a fruit just plucked. Tomorrow I lift you, bird of bones, limbs softly collapsed. There is sunlight crawling across the lawn. Despite the drought, it's resiliently green, except the narrow path of old sod we laid. How traumatized by neglect into a crude buzz cut. And this, too, is a symbol of what we've lost. It is August in Colombia. Nothing can fight in this heat. Just stay still. Maybe a small wind will blow. Maybe a small wind. In my life, I've written many poems for my father. My father is Neville Dawes. He's a writer. And he taught me a great deal. Most of what he taught me, I learned after he died. He died in an accident in 1984. And it makes sense because he was a writer and I became a writer. And there's a sense in which that connection happens and I write a lot about him and so on. But, about 10, 12 years ago, I started to think about what makes me who I am. And I thought of my mother, who is an artist, a sculptor, and a social worker. And in many ways, it's the combination of this Marxist, my father, the Marxist writer, and my mother, the social work artist, that makes up who I am and how I see myself. But I hadn't written a lot of poems about my mother. And so I decided that I was going to write poems for my mother. And so they're decidedly sentimental. And not just decidedly, but doggedly sentimental. Defiantly sentimental. Because I can do that sometimes. And I'm going to end with a decidedly sentimental poem for my mother. And we call her Mama the Great. And because she was an amazing woman, she is an amazing woman. She's the one who, when my father was in Ghana, wrapping up his life in Ghana in 1971, which meant drinking every bit of money that we had left and having a good time while we were struggling in England, she picked up a job working in a hotel, cleaning rooms. She would make additional extra money, gambling, on the horses, and she was very good. She would always make a little money on the horses. And she kept us together in a remarkable and powerful way. And she's the one I remember. She'd be driving home, taking us down a hill, she'd let go of the steering wheel, and we thought this woman was God. She just stopped holding the steering wheel and the car just kept going. And so we'd chant, Mama the Great, Mama the Great, Mama the Great. So forgive my sentiment because, she's my mom. So this is called Your Hands, the Hands of a Sculptor, for Mama. A mother cradles her child even when the head grows too cumbersome for embrace. And you who remain constant through these years, it is hard to make poems for you since I come always as a heavy head longing to be soothed. It is mother love I have learned, the tenderness of your sculptor's palms greasy with Vicks on my skin, the gentle intrusion of your fingers searching my balls for maddening worms, the quick brush of your massage, slick with pink lotion, softening the itchy, scratched sores of the pox, the calming voice, never panicked, even when I walked in at 2 a.m, my body splotched with welts the size of an open palm from eating 10 too many crab cakes. If it has not killed you yet, it won't go to sleep. Still, after years, after imagining that I have deserved your grace for my good son ways, it is clear to me now that you always knew me for the fragile child I was, the careful manager of my pathologies, the marathon masturbation binges, the secreted clandestine letters to lovers, the fear of the dark, the terror of failure, and yet you have loved, and what you have loved has never changed. My infant, my heart, my navel string, the umbilicus that ties me to you, to home, to Ghana, to the instant when the impossible pain of childbirth propelled me out, and then those five seasons when I was the washbelly, the last child, the baby, this love was built on the sacramental truth of those years. Your hands molded my flesh, understanding the pressure of skin on skin. And it makes sense that you would love him, the one who came after me, love him through everything, like you have loved me, for that love too was shaped in the basic fluid and pain of birthing. How you love is myth, as simple as rainfall and dew at dawn. My arrogance is my millstone, and until this stumbling into tears and the hunger for forgiveness and love, I had not grasped the memory of your clay white hands, the familiar intimacy of your touch. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you very much for listening. Take care. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Wow. That's amazing. That was really, really something.
Thanks.
So like I just realized that every time I hang out with you, there's so much code switching. Yeah. Linguistically,
yeah.
That I forget sometimes. And so during the introduction, I kept saying, jealous, jealous. And I thought, wait a minute. In America, that means something completely different.
That's right.
Because in West Africa, to say you're jealous is to say you're in awe.
That's right.
Because, you know, only God can have awe. So, like, you know, where I come from, it's a big honor. I know you know this. I just wanted the audience to to realize that we weren't frenemies.
No, that's not that, there's enough of that out there. We don't need
you
that.
You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, nice work, man.
You know? Thank you.
As they say back home, calling down fire.
Fire.
We'll and come again.
Yeah.
So, I guess we're going to have a conversation. It's a real honor, you know. I don't know. I remember when I gave you a manuscript of poems that were really, really bad. My first manuscript, and Kwame read through them, and so he said to me, so what is the guiding aesthetic here? And I said, the African griot. And he said to me, boy, I'm so tired of people blaming bad poetry on
African griot.
So it's nice to be able to talk to you about this. Now, I'm wondering where to begin. Mm-hmm. I don't get paid by Apple, but I also have an iPad. But
there you go.
But I guess since we just talked about this idea of code switching, I want to ask you about the idea of shape-shifting. Mm-hmm. Because in many ways, you straddle multiple genres, multiple identities, multiple passports even possibly, multiple homes, and so forth. But there is a unique vision you bring that seems to infuse all this with a rare transformational power. And I know you talked a lot about the Fisheries Commission.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, Kwame is the only one I know who can take money from a funding body to study salmon and write a book about masculinity. You know, and so there's this way in which the salmon became this powerful ideas. So I was wondering, you know, is this easy for you, this straddling, these ideas of travel, and how do you navigate not only the straddling, linguistically and otherwise, but also this idea of belonging. Do you belong anywhere?
Yeah, clearly that's the question at the core of, I think, most of what I write, because I'm writing, I think, about a lyric about home and the idea of defining home. And there's a sense in which the circumstances of my life, and Chris's life is not unlike that, is that we are both people who are always from somewhere else, but always from where we are. This is a real odd contradiction. When I was in Ghana, I was born in Ghana. My father was Jamaican and my mother is Ghanaian. When I was born in Ghana, I was a Ghanaian, but my father always told stories about Jamaica. And so And he would always end his elaborate tales about Jamaica with the caveat. He said, so we're going home soon. We're going to go home soon. And so built into my whole psyche was the idea that while I was in Ghana, where my grandmother and grandfather, my, you know, oodles of cousins were, I still had a sense that there was another place that was being called home that I was going to return to. So I'm both here and outside of here. When I moved to England, we were in transition. So we were from Ghana, we were going to Jamaica. So there's always that sense of being in and out and yet trying to find rooting and identity there. When I got to Jamaica, I got home. Well, turns out there was a little more hype in my father's telling. We were expecting, you know, donkey rides and, you know, acres and acres of farmland. We landed in Kingston. Not quite the same thing. But even in Jamaica, which was in a sense home, I was a foreigner. I was coming from Africa. And so home was Africa. And yet home was Jamaica. This has been a perpetual condition, but the characteristic that I think is most important and relevant to the writing is that I've committed myself to find home wherever I am. In other words, to find a place of rooting through an engagement with the space that I enter into. Because I've accepted that I'm in this kind of nomadic kind of situation. But it's ideal for the writer, frankly, because I think the writer wants to be both in the moment and yet have some distance from the moment to be able to create. This is where the craft works, having some distance, looking at it from the outside, but yet not losing the passion of being inside it. And for me, that is part of the excitement about what it means to be a writer and so on. So the wrestle with home is a wrestle to always try and find a grounding, and then you change shape, right? You learn how to speak like a South Carolinian, just in case somebody gets funny about things, you know. You learn to and that's the superficial part of it. The in depth side of it is that you come to find where your rooting is, where your point of connection is. So that is important to me, and I think that comes through in my work. I don't feel I'm in a dilemma. I don't feel I'm in a crisis. I don't feel I don't have a home. Because in a sense, I know where my root is. Mm-hmm. And it gives me confidence to enter the space. And my root is bifurcated. It is Jamaica, it is Ghana. And it gives me confidence to enter into any kind of space. And I think that comes through in the work that I do.
Cool. Yes. Yeah. Well, just following off of that, I want to get into language a bit.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's funny, I use the phrase, I carry a pocket full of accents.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know if I stole that from you, but if I did, you know.
No, you didn't. All right. But, I might steal it from you.
It's pretty good, Chris.
That's a good
but,
one.
But there is this way in which you carry a pocket full of, and I, you know, I when I'm in Jamaica, I start to speak Patois without thinking.
Yeah, that's right.
And I have Scottish great-grandparents, and you know, and then when I was a kid and we used to go there, they always used to be like, ha, definitely that poor wee, what was it, the poor wee darkies, a wee drum, you know. So, and my, I never stood like, not every hoose is a him. And I said, what the hell? You know, but it's this, it's partly being an immigrant, perpetual immigrant, but it's also connected to the condition of being a writer, which is an outsider, but that there is a way in which we're always, we can sound American, we can sound however we want to, and we start mimicking without realizing. Yeah. Now, in your work, there are these beautiful shifts from standard English into Patois, in within one line. Mm. And it's funny, it reminds me of the way Stevie Wonder works with registers. So you move in that, and you move in the next line, diving into like a Ghanaian metaphor, but it's still in English. And so I was curious about this. Like, language for you seems to be plastic. It seems to be something that is fluid. How do you come to your writing in terms of language? And do you find language to be that the one place that erases these ridiculous ideas of passports and nation and all this? Not that they're ridiculous, but the limiting ideas of nation.
I wish they would do away with the passports because it can be, you know, it's very tricky at the airport and so on. But yeah, the language is languages, I grew up in Ghana. So, you know, in my first few years in Ghana, I was speaking Ga, Fan, Titri, Ewe. These were languages that I spoke. I've lost the ability to speak them over the years, but I understand what is going on. You know, that weird way, I don't know if anybody has had language as a child, where you hear a mass of noise and you can't isolate the individual words, but the thing is making some weird kind of sense. It's very spooky. You don't know what I'm talking about, but that's all right. but so language is really an interesting thing for me. But you know, one of the things that is telling about the way I use Patois and so on is that I learned Patois. And this is one of the advantages of my life. Because as a Jamaican writer, I had to learn, as just a Jamaican, a kid growing up in Jamaica, I had to learn this new language. Most Jamaicans never even think that they have a language. Right. It's their mother tongue, they grew up speaking it and so on. But I had to learn it. I had to sit down and think, how do I say this phrase in the Jamaican language? And I would say, no, you can't say it this way. You have to say it this way. And I found myself playing with syntax and structure in a way that made me realize I'm dealing with a full language here. This is a kid about 12 years old, 11, 12, 13 years old, trying to learn this language. But what it's done for me as a writer is that I take the patois and I'm able to pull from it all kinds of nuances and shapes and ideas, because it's close enough to English for you to play that kind of game with. And I find myself enjoying that kind of play. And every place that I go to, I try to sort of learn what the rhythms are, what the languages are, and so on, and see how they can play into my writing. But I think for most writers, we are always trying to find the language of the greatest sort of comfort line, the place where you know you're most comfortable, that you find that language, and then you spin that into the poetics of that language. And it's very interesting, because my kids, they can tell when I'm angry, because my accent becomes more Ghanaian.
Well, because you know, African accents are good for anger.
They're terribly good for anger.
Oh. If I touch you,
oh,
you're still talking.
You're still talking.
Yeah, it's an intimidating accent.
Yeah. But for the writer, I mean, language is fascinating to me, and. Yeah. And I think that play is something that I can pull from significantly. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. You wrote this really beautiful nuanced book about the reggae aesthetic, mm-hmm. and you know, reggae has had such an important life, not only in the Caribbean, but in Africa, on mm-hmm. the whole continent. You know, for years in Nigeria, we thought Bob Marley was a Nigerian. And we're very disappointed to find out he wasn't.
Yeah.
Because reggae creates a sense of ownership, of belonging to it in a way. And because it's a studio music, it's a complex music.
That's right.
It's not sort of something that comes out of spontaneity. It's very thought through. It's very intellectual. In this way that even someone like Derek Walcott, when he was asked what poem he wished he had written, it was No Woman, No Cry by Bob Marley.
Yeah, that's right.
And so this is the thing that, and so you're a reggae musician, mm-hmm. and so you have this reggae aesthetic. And it's sort of, in many ways, as I can boil it down briefly, encapsulates the idea of politics, spirituality, and the ideas of the eros, erotic, yeah. all combined into one. And the poem you read about the woman in the immigration room, with the customs, I think is a perfect sort of a rendition in many ways. But could you talk a little bit more about the reggae aesthetic, where it may connect to the blues, where it diverts from jazz? Because I know you work with all of these.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if there's anything that gives me a kind of grounding as a writer and the confidence to write, it has been my engagement with reggae music. And this is kind of important, because I'm a product of colonialism and post-colonialism, and I should explain what I mean by that. You know, I born in Ghana, grew up in Jamaica. These are countries that were formerly colonized by Britain. I had an incredibly great education, and the education was largely modeled on the British model of education. I come from the generation, the post-independence generation, which means that those who were before me, that is my father and his generation, were British citizens. They were colonized by the British and lived in that space. And one of the interesting dynamics of my father's life is that weird schizophrenia between his rabid anti-colonialist views and ideas and actions, And his almost pathological love for Britain and for English things. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, my father would speak in an Oxford accent. You know, he was an Oxford man, you know. And so I'm saying, this is not making sense because you are the great Pan-Africanist and so on. And the best of them reconcile themselves to this contradiction, this weird kind of double-headedness and double-mindedness about things. I came from a generation that did not have to suffer that, but I also came from a generation that in my learning and my education, I was reading Enid Blyton and you know all the everything from Britain, you know, so that became the sort of literary basis for what I was doing. And in a sense, one day we asked ourselves the question, me and my siblings, was, where are we in the Five Find Outers? Where are we, in Jennings Follows a Clue? We love that stuff, but where were we? We were nowhere to be found. And this was a very odd thing. But not only were we not physically present, but the landscape we knew and we lived in was not present. Yeah. And I remember reading a short story called Sprat Morrison by Jean DaCosta is the name of the writer. She was this children's book. And it was about a boy, a fat boy, growing up in Kingston, and he lived in Papine. I knew Papine. I mean, I went to Papine all the time. And he lived there, and he ate mangoes, and he played cricket, and he looked like me, and he talked like me. And I was completely flabbergasted by this revelation of my landscape in the language of a book, within a book. Now, this may seem unextraordinary to some of you, but for somebody in a post-colonial situation, it is quite remarkable. And I think that what happens for me is that the quest to write became a quest to try and make that landscape be present in the work that I do, be present in my understanding of what I'm doing. And to break that bifurcated position. So when reggae music became the soundtrack for my life in the 1970s, in a sense, this music began to do exactly that thing in an amazing way to me. Because when Bob Marley would sing, and I walk up First Street, and then I walk up Second Street to see Natty Dread, and I ride on through Third Street to see Natty Dread. Or when he says, it's Kingston 12, no one, you figure long, so it's Queen Kingston. That's my place. He's naming the landscape. He's naming the place. And when he philosophizes, misty morning, don't see no sun, I know you're out there somewhere having fun. There is one mystery I just can't express. Why you give your more to receive your less. The power of philosophy flows through my head, light like a feather, heavy as lead. I thought, whoa, this is pop music. This is popular music. This is the music that is playing on the radio. Burning Spear singing, do you remember the days of slavery? Do you remember the days of slavery? This was the music I was growing up with. But it was music that wasn't only relevant to our lives in Jamaica, but it was international, and it was going all over the place. And so in that music, I found this aesthetic, this capacity to do this political thing, while at the same time, it be music of sensuality, it be music of faith and belief and so on. And I found in it a framework within which I, as an artist, could begin to start carving out an identity as a writer and a voice as a writer. And it's both a spiritual dynamic, it's a philosophical dynamic, and it's an intellectual dynamic. And of course, it has that visceral emotional dynamic to it. And so reggae music became the framing for me for the work that I do. And that has continued to be the case. It doesn't mean that you'll hear a poem and go, oh, there's the reggae. Because the reggae, the aesthetic of reggae has to do with cosmology, has to do with a kind of philosophical understanding of how you approach the world, which is more than just a good rhythm that goes check it, check it, check it. It's more than that. There's something else that is going on in it. And for me, that has been important. And of course, as I tell people, when you come from a small place and you go elsewhere, you want people to be able to say, I know who you are, where you're from. You want that. You don't know what I'm talking about because America, like, you know, anywhere you go, America, everybody knows what America is, right? But
they think they do.
They think they do, right. They think they do, right. But it's named and so. But if you say I come from Jamaica, 2.5 million people. No, most people would think Jamaica has like 5 million people or 20 million people. It's just 2.5 million people. But this music is like the ticket, the legitimacy of one's presence in the world. And for me as a writer, that has been hugely important. Hugely important. Yeah.
Well, you've answered the next question, which I was going to ask, which had to do with landscape and the idea of, you know, because for you, landscape is not only physical.
No.
It's historical.
Yeah.
It's spiritual. It's philosophical.
Yeah.
And it's always a site of resistance and redemption.
Yeah.
And but your landscapes in your work cover everything, America, mm-hmm. South Carolina, mm-hmm. Ghana, Jamaica. But I think that is, so I want to move to another question,
yeah.
though, which has to do with myth-making.
Mm.
So a lot of your books, including Goma Song, which, you know, you were generous enough to give the Black Goat, but you have taken on the rewriting of sort of in Jaco Jacobus, which is Jacob with the angel, Goma Song, all of this rewriting these biblical narratives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in an intellectual environment, it's a dirty word to talk about one's spirituality.
Yeah.
But I feel like there is more at play here. And I'm curious to why you renegotiate that territory. Is it again with this idea of reggae where you're recapturing a religion that has seemed foreign and trying to find? And the only reason I remember this is when I read that first poem and I could see this connection.
Yeah.
But what is it for you?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. You know, some years ago, in the 90s, just when about the time we met Chris in the mid 90s, I was in an interesting place as a writer because I had published a couple of poetry collections. I'd won a fairly major award and so on. And I was trying to work through what it means to be a writer and how do you negotiate the politics of being a writer. And there's a culture around writing that sometimes is very resistant to the idea of anything spiritual, and it's a sort of belief that comes through. There's a sense in which it's perceived as anti-intellectual or intimidating, sort of aggressively intimidating and so on. And I remember sort of wrestling with this idea because, of course, I have this thing called faith. I really do. It is part of who I am. It's part of my identity and so on. And I started to ask the question, do I jettison that part of my sense of who I am so that I might have the success that I want? Which is, it's great. It's like Faustian, you know, it's like the whole conundrum. Do I sell my soul for an award or something like that? It doesn't sound so good when you put it that way, but you know what I'm talking about. And it really became an interesting question for me. And the answer that I came to was that I had committed myself to be as faithful to who I am, to what I sound like, to my history, to my narrative, to my experience, to my world, as I can be. And if I'm going to be a good poet or a great poet, I'm going to do that on those terms. That can't change. If this is the language I'm stuck with, then I'll make this language sing. If this is the country I was born in, then this country is going to sing. If this is the faith that I live with, then this is going to have to find a way to sing. If these are my children, then they will sing. I have to find a way to make that work. And one of the attractions of the reggae aesthetic for me was that it gave me a brilliant framework and an example of how the spiritual engages with the political, engages with the sensual, and yet creates these moments of sublime and moving reality and understanding. I mean, you may think, you know, Bob Marley, great rebellious guy, smokes weed and so on and so forth. But Bob Marley was fundamentally a religious man. His songs are all religious. It would be like Bob was a gospel singer. Just a really cool gospel singer. Right? But the reason we engage with Bob is that we reached the lyric truth of himself. When he sings, "My woman is gone," she had left me a note hanging from my door. She said she couldn't take it, she couldn't take anymore. The pressures around me just couldn't see. She felt like a prisoner who needs to be free. Fools have tried, wise men have failed. Oh, listen to me, honey, life could never be another jail. But still we know now we'll never see smoke without fire. And everyone you see has a heart's desire. She's gone. She's gone. She's gone. That is a man sort of carrying his heart on the sleeve. Oh, my children, if you see me crying, my woman is gone. It's bare. It's raw. It's open. And yet it is built around the idea when he sings, "If Jah didn't love I, would I be alive today? Will I be around to say, give thanks and praises to the Most High?" It's all part of that dynamic. And for me as a writer, that is permission to enter into the poetics of whatever moment I can find. And for me, the narratives of Jacob, of Gomer, I mean, I am engaging them, I'm challenging them, I'm teasing them, I'm testing them, I'm pulling from them, I'm recasting them, I'm subverting them and doing all those things with it. But I feel I have permission to enter that space. Now, some people won't like it. It's true. But as they say, tough cookies.
So, you know, I've already talked a bit about the mentoring you've done, particularly for young poets.
Yeah.
And I know that from about 96 to now, most of the young poets published in Jamaica and in London, actually, are directly either through your workshop manuscripts or through you publishing them as an editor of a series, and also fiction.
Yeah.
So in a way, there is this way in which I feel you're doing that. You're doing the South Carolina Poetry Initiative.
That's right.
You've gone around with Wisteria recording the voices of women, essentially women, mm-hmm. who are being erased by history.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've gone to do this work on AIDS in Jamaica mm-hmm. and now in Haiti.
In Haiti, yeah.
So there's a way in which you are a one-man institution building. Mm-hmm. Without it being an institution building, but in a way you are leaving this huge legacy. But because we're running low on time, I really just wanted to come into the most recent ones. Because I am proof. I'm living proof of the work you did in London. Yeah. You know, my career sort of takes off with the breakthroughs that happened in that workshop. But with recording, and this is tied into young people, because young people are a group you're very interested in, invested in. But talk about hope, about this idea of the people living with AIDS in Jamaica, what you did with that.
Yeah.
And if witness is enough, is there a limit to compassion?
Yeah.
All of these things in the work you're doing in Haiti now.
Yeah, it's tough, and especially doing the work in Haiti, because I've done 3 trips to Haiti, and I'll do a couple more. I've been talking to people who are living with HIV in Haiti and struggling with the earthquake. Just powerful stories of lives that people are living. You know, I met a boy 17 years old. He got HIV/AIDS from his mother, contracted it in childbirth. I remember sitting there, she's sitting beside him, and we're talking, and he says, he literally almost gives the whole speech of the temper, you know, of Caliban saying, you know, "I cry to dream again." He says, I laugh and then I cry and then I laugh and then sometimes I dream. And then he says, I wonder why, you know, what did my mother do to me? What did this happen to me? And I start crying, because there's no answer to these questions. He knows that. I know that. But all I have. All I have is the capacity to tell the story. And there is something affirming about voicing that story. It's not that he's voiceless. It's just that I have a gift to use language to capture what feelings there may be. He has a voice in his own space, and he articulates that. But I have a gift to use language in what way to articulate it and to express it. And one of the things that I found healing for me is the capacity to write poems or to write essays and to tell the stories of people living with HIV and people living in the really difficult conditions that are happening in Haiti. I mean, in fact, I'm working on an anthology. You know, when I was in Haiti, I decided, you know, I'm there, so I might as well meet the poets. You know what I mean? So, you know, why not? And so I arranged a meeting and a gathering of poets, and they came out and we talked, and I said, "How are you writing about the earthquake?" And this was in April, and they said, "We can't." I said, how can we?" They said, "The poem is, look at, that's the poem. We, to put words to that would be the biggest insult in the world. We can't. And I said, but you must. You must. I mean, this is what you're called to. If you are a writer, this is when you come through. This is what you must do. And I've been there a couple of times. Now we are doing an anthology of poetry written after the earthquake. And I've been getting the poems in, and they're in Creole and they're in French, and they're just stunning and they're just moving and so on. And, you know, we're searching for funds to do the translation and so on. But we want this book to come out, to commemorate the earthquake. For me, that is exciting. And it was just wonderful to see the senior poets talking to the younger poets, who they never do. And this was the thing in England. This was the problem in England. You know, I was sitting there and I was saying, I knew all the senior poets. I knew all these young poets. They never spoke to each other.
Right.
And my thing was, you guys got to talk to each other. I mean, this is crazy. And this is I saw that happening in Haiti, and it's just powerful. And for me, that is exciting. You know, that's the kind of work that I will continue to do. And the good thing about working with writers is, if they end up like Chris Abani, I mean, you know, it's like, this is great for my resume. Look at this, Chris Abani. I you know, some people say, you know, Chris Abani. I taught that boy, man. Everything he knows, I taught him all that stuff. But the truth is, Chris was where he was before we met. But it's been fantastic to be able to work with writers and to see that develop.
One last question, because we are out of time, and a short answer. You. Clearly, everything you do is hugely political, but it's also tempered in this deep humanity, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, it reminds me, I was just in South Africa for the World Cup interviewing, and I asked them, is apartheid over? And they said, no. And I said, well, but everyone thinks it is, so how do you fight it?
Yeah.
And they told me this joke. The guy said that after Nelson Mandela's inauguration, a group of people were flying back to their homelands, and it was a small plane, eight people, two black people, a man and his son. And as they leave Johannesburg, about 30 minutes out, an engine goes out. And the captain comes on and says, ladies and gentlemen, we have a crisis. Plane engine has gone out. We need two people to volunteer to jump off the plane. And nobody moves. So he says, well, in the spirit of the new South Africa, we would like to go alphabetically. Will all the Africans please jump off the plane? And nobody moves. And he says, will all the blacks jump off the plane? Nobody moves. And he says, all the colors jump off the plane? Nobody moves. So this boy turns to his father and says, father, if we're not African and we're not black and we're not colored, what are we? And he says, today, my son, we're Zulu. that kind of, you know, I just remember again the immigration poem. That's the sort of way in which the humor is itself a state of resistance.
Yeah.
But we both grew up with similar. My father went to Oxford too and all that stuff. We both grew up Marxist, Nigerians, Pan-African and all that.
Yeah.
And we both live in America now. Yours is more complicated. You have children who are U.S. citizens.
I have American children.
And now
Shocking.
You have become an American citizen.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know, has your politics changed?
Yeah.
If it's changed, how has it changed as you get older? And was it a struggle to get that blue passport?
Yeah, getting a passport is a trip, man. You should try that. Getting a U.S. passport. That's it. Especially if you had a Ghanaian passport. Like my wife has a British, had a British passport. So of course we applied at the same time. In a few weeks, she was ready. They were ready to interview her and she was ready to go. And I am waiting years. I said, so I called them and I said, what's the deal here? They, oh, you know, it's just, it's, you know, your surnames. I said, no, we got the same surname. That's not, that they said, you know, these things happen and so on. Obviously, you know, it was the issue of the passport. But that's a good question, Chris. Have my politics changed? I don't know if they've changed, actually. Because you see, the weird thing is that growing up with a Marxist doesn't make you a pure Marxist at all. In fact, it makes you very ironic about Marxism. you have a kind of, first of all, there's a gut reaction to certain things. Oppression, the duplicity of political games, the inequalities and so on. There's a kind of visceral and gut reaction to it that I don't think will ever change. That's in my DNA. But absurdities in Marxism. You know, my father was the guy that said, you know, You know, we had a chance to buy a house. You know, we were renting and all that. And, you know, these Jamaicans had run away in the 1970s because they thought socialism was coming. And, of course, we proudly stayed. And but they had their houses, and we were renting the house, and they were selling their houses. They were from Miami. They were selling their houses. And, of course, so my father, you know, we got a dirt cheap, you know. And my mother says, you know, Neville, we should buy the house. And Neville says, I'm a Marxist. We don't own property. What? So he dies and left nothing. He left debt. You know, I'm saying, so you kind of say, well, you know, so you recognize the absurdity of some of those arrangements, but what was left with me, and I think it's still there, that it's the human reality. What happens to the human being? That becomes the most important issue, the true life of the human being, and the willingness to sacrifice a great deal for your principles and your values. And if there's anything that my father taught me through his socialism, it's that. But the other thing is, coming to America was not easy for me. It wasn't my plan. You know, I'll say one last thing, because I know we're out of time. But my father is the dude who vowed never to step foot in this country. So when we were traveling from Ghana to Jamaica, he would send us, the kids and my mother, through JFK. It was cheaper that way, and then fly. And he would take a boat. Right? He'll take a boat, right, across the Atlantic to Jamaica so that he didn't have to stop in America. That's how serious he was. So you imagine me landing in America with a gig and so on and so forth. I mean, I thought, boy, that man is just like spinning in his grave. But that's not the heart of it. At the end of the day, your father is not defined by his political position, but by his humanity. This is the man who gave up a writing career so that his children could grow up and have food and could be looked after. This is the man who never left us. He was always with us. He was always there and always supportive in his own way, in a remarkable way. And those are the fundamental lessons that don't change. So you know, I don't only live in America, but I live in South Carolina. You know how hard that is? That's a red state, boy. That's so red.
It's like a flame on the back.
Oh, it's like a flame on the back of the neck. Yeah, but we'll see.
We'll see. Thank you, Santa Fe. Thank you, Pamela.
Thank you. Thank you, too.
Don't forget, there's a book signing afterwards.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.